welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. For this episode, I'm very pleased. I feel like it's a testimony to the warping and wefting, if that's a word, in the past 2 years that somehow has been like a year and a half since we last did a podcast. But I'm very pleased to be back talking again with Bruce Bennett. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Nick.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And it's nice to be back. And it's nice to be, I mean, when you and I spoke last, it was one of the sort of kind of major social moments coming out of the pandemic for me. So it's nice not to be in that moment again.
For sure. Yeah. I think at that time I'm not even sure where I was, geographical or mental sense, but I think I've progressed by now. And I think, again, we have another raft of intriguing films to talk about. I mean, I know last time, I hope everyone has listened to that episode. And I think there's some of those films are still on the Criterion channel that we talked about. Mm-hmm. I think this is a special episode too, that we'll be talking about some movies that are maybe harder to see, but no less worth people's time if they do a little hunting. And one film that maybe we can jump off with came to mind a little bit because Jerzy Skolimowski, who has gotten one of these late career triumphs that gives a person a well-deserved spotlight again, EO, aka the Donkey Odyssey. And it's also, you know, opportunity to look at his past movies, which, because it's kind of funny because he's a person who I feel like has like emerged a number of times in his career in different ways, but was definitely like in a heyday, late 60s and 70s of golden age art house cinema. Anyway, I'm being really long-winded. The movie is Deep End, and I was very pleased to hear that this was kind of a big movie for you.
Yeah, it's really a personal favorite, and it's, you know, one of the many delusions I don't permit myself anymore at this advanced age is like I'm really not much of a pantheon keeper and a list maker and that kind of thing, but I honestly can say I just entirely from a personal, like, I don't necessarily recommend it, but it just is a movie that is the top five movies of all time for me, that like just in terms of sort of casting kind of an emotional shadow on me. And, you know, it's a weird union of movie and time that I first saw it. I mean, it's very much a movie about teenage sexuality, I guess, like, or like aspirational teenage sexuality. And I saw it as a very, like, you know, characteristically conflicted teen, for the first time in Repertory in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, I don't know like anybody ever sort of like celebrates this or not, but like Washington, D.C. totally randomly in the late 70s when I was in junior high school and high school there was just like old movie Valhalla. There were so many Repertory film theaters and Repertory film options available back then that I kind of literally stumbled into it as the bottom half of a double feature with Performance. And it just blew my mind. I mean, I'd never seen anything that really encapsulated like how incredibly difficult and unrewarding it was being a teenager. And I really love that about it. And I continue to love about it. Like every time I've revisited it.
I can only imagine what it would be like to see this movie at an age, yeah, anything close to the age of the protagonist in the movie. I interviewed him recently and he just referred to him like he was, you know, someone alive and around. It was kind of great. Mike. He was just talking, oh, and Mike was a different character.
Played by John Mulder Brown, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And he's just 15 years old.
It's been a while for me. I remember the hair more than anything else. I mean, I'd like to be honest here. I remember Jane Asher. I mean, like, that's what I remember. But I, you know, like his sort of look, he just seemed to have that kind of that 15-year-old boy hair that just never seems to go away. Like it would look perfectly, you know, inept and silly in like a late 70s high school yearbook or, you know, or now or whatever, like the sort of like simultaneously kind of over-maintained and unkempt, like dumb teenage boy hair.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like one of the kids in Funny Pages to me, you know?
Yeah, it's true that, yeah, there's permanent flop of hair. Yeah. Which kind of, that's really a good way of putting it, cause it kind of describes where he's at. Cause he's right in this like perfectly ungainly moment where, you know, everything seems awkward. He's like, he's kind of lurching around like a cult, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's just, for people who haven't seen it, he works just taking a job at this like public bath / pool. And he's an attendant there. And he's sort of learning the ropes, and his boss yes, is Jane Asher. This is set in London, but right? But I wasn't sure what neighborhood.
Well, there's good reason for that. It's set in London, and I think of like whatever the month they spent shooting it, maybe 3 days actually were in England. The whole thing was shot in Munich. Almost the entire thing was shot in Munich for financial reasons.
Wow.
So, I mean, it like, you know, this sort of vision of like the least swinging version of swinging London possible. Like, I think the fact that they shot it in Munich only sort of added to the magic, you know?
Yeah. The big thing in the movie is him having this extended nightmare sequence a sequence that really feels like the parts in a book or a movie where some kid has been up too late and is like padding around in his PJs, you know, like Land Where the Wild Things Are or something, sure. Except in swinging London, which for some reason, this like the fulcrum of it is this hot dog salesman. Do you remember that?
Sure. Bert Koch. I'm slaughtering his surname, but it, like a ubiquitous, I think the Chinese English character actor of that era. Like he turns up in like all of those thankless, you know, the roles that somebody that ethnic derivation at that time would end up being like, he's, you know, sort of like a Tong warrior or whatever in a Hammer movie, this, that, and the other, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's just going through this like attachment crisis. And yeah. There's this great part of that sequence where he finds a full size photo cutout of Jane Asher's character that must be her. I mean, but I don't know if it's ever clear that it's actually her. I think she denies it, you know, this kind of racy cutout that was to be placed outside like a strip club or something. So he just grabs it and he's carrying that around.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Being at that age and just trying to sort of carry on instinct and experience when you basically don't have any instincts or any experience of any kind to help you. Like it does really make it like you describe it perfectly. It's just one of those kind of like wandering around the night kitchen kind of things, except like in essentially the sleaziest part of Soho or whatever Munich streets passing for Soho, like around porn theaters and all this kind of stuff. So it's really cool because it's just, you know, yeah, sure. He's lost, feckless, obsessed, but powerless, and sort of truly in a world of sort of sexual commerce and all of this stuff that like he's too young for and doesn't belong in anyway, you know, and just like fucking it all up, you know, like that strange sense of like being on a mission and being utterly powerless at the same time, which is kind of what sort of how he presents throughout the movie. I think the cutout, if I remember correctly, it does figure in the climax of the film, which, you know, there's no point in describing literally because it's pretty shocking and surprising when it comes around. But I think the cutout is also sort of in there with her and him, you know, in the fateful waters at the end of the film.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that her character, Jane Asher's character, we do get a sense of like kind of where she's actually at in her romantic and sexual life. And I do feel that if she were actually doing something in some Soho club that, you know, or in a film or a loop or whatever, that would earn her a cardboard cutout, it probably would have gotten discussed in those scenes in the movie. So it does end up sort of being this kind of, you know, almost like sort of dream trope kind of token talisman kind of thing. I mean, not only is it not explained, but there's pretty strong arguments for it both being her, the cutout, I mean, both being her and not being her, which just adds to the weirdness, you know, and it's this two-dimensional photographic black and white thing in a movie that has this incredibly bizarre and reduced color palette, you know, and where everything just seems like it's sort of shot through like, you know, like a dirty towel or something. I don't know, like, like a torn pair of pantyhose or something like that. It just is sort of, it's yet another like sort of examined and not examined thing at the same time, you know, that just adds to the dusky magic of it all.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm glad you talked about the camera on this, because something that's maybe kind of a characteristic for Skolimowski that I definitely think comes up here is just the particular quality of the camera movement and just the mobile kind of camera that he has, which isn't, you know, it isn't like a kind of jittery handheld. It's really strange. When I was really paying attention to it and reading a bit of interviews with him, did I understand how pretty distinctive it is. It's this weird type of move that signifies some kind of like something, you know, I mean, it, right. You know, you're sort of careening around a bit with him. There's something reckless. It's just a real feeling of instability that is a particular thing he does, which I then thought about, reflected on when I with EO, because that movie has all sorts of stuff going on with the camera that's really creative that sometimes harkens back to it, the way it sets you off balance with what it does and sort of defamiliarizes you. And here it like, yeah, really keys into his, I don't know, teenage ungainliness somehow.
Yeah, it's extremely distinctively photographed movie. And it's the phrase that I co-opted from a DP friend of mine years ago to describe what it is that like, and I know it's condolences. It's an extremely difficult thing to describe, but it's really vivid when you see the movie. And it's also in a bunch of his other movies. I haven't seen EO, although I've seen Captain EO. But the one that I think of is Riff Raff. The one about the guys working in London, the Polish guys working in London.
Yes. Yeah. The Jeremy Irons.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. The phrase that my friend Peter uses is it's really well operated, meaning, you know, the cameraman's job of operating the camera, of like moving it around or whatever. Like it's not handheld for handheld's sake, but it's also not these, you know, sort of would-be classical Hollywood or German silent kind of, you know, elaborate camera moves. You know, there's a lot of scrutiny, but there's also a lot of distance at the same time. And it's right off the bat, as I recall, like the movie begins, if I remember correctly, with just like we're examining the shape of a bicycle frame. And it's really beautiful and really, I mean, as idiotic as that sounds, as, you know, as a spoken sentence, it's really kind of fascinating, transformative kind of scrutiny without it really feeling like scrutiny, without it feeling like this, you know, the director taking you by the back of the head and forcing you to look kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's the guy's got a real gift for that. I'm glad he's still working. Is he 1,000 years old now or something?
He is in his, I want to say, early to mid 80s. Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Him and Walter Hill back in action.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's been like, yeah, and then Frederick Wiseman also, I think he's 90.
Well, you can't call him. He's just going to, yeah.
The Titanium Bones. That's, I don't know, sounds like a lost Philip K. Dick title. The Titanium Bones of Mr. Wiseman.
Frederick Wiseman, yeah.
Yeah, with the bike, I know what you're talking about. It really is beautiful, and it's not like it's gliding or trying to imitate the movement. It's just how it's moving around it. It's pretty remarkable. So it makes me want to go back to a couple of movies, because I did see like a few of his movies, of all places, at the Jeonju Film Festival in Jeonju, Korea.
Oh, wow.
When they put on a pretty complete retrospective. And I saw them there, including Le Départ, the one with Jean-Pierre Léo, where he plays a race car driver, I think. I don't remember that one that well. I remember it being kind of goofy, but that kind of comes with him. And like The Shout, I haven't seen The right. Shout in ages.
Yeah, I was crawling towards that one. I mean, like that was, you know, I mean, The Shout was amazing at the time. These things as movies, they really hang in my memory as much as the sort of, you know, the works of art or whatever you want to call it that they are themselves, but also just the experience of where I was in my life when I saw them. And The Shout, like I remember it sort of came out, you know, there still was, you know, again, in DC at the time, and I might have been in New York by then, but they're similarly both cities, like a lot of other, you know, LA, other places in America in the late 70s and early 80s, there was enough of a art film audience and enough of a art film distributorship and enough cinemas that would book this stuff or whatever, that these things were coming out all the time. And The Shout came out like around the time that this sort of, I think Miramax was kind of leading the charge with what was referred to at the time as the new Australian cinema. And The Shout by no means is an Australian movie, but I think it was shot in Australia. So I remember sort of lapping it up with the same kind of appetite that, like, you know, The Last Wave or Picnic at the Hanging Rock or, you know, like that kind of thing. Cause it is sort of, if I remember correctly, it's sort of supernatural and sort of not.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of haunted landscape movie in a way. I mean, he shouts and people die.
Yeah, it's, but yeah, I mean, Deep End. Again, I can't get over the fact that it's shot in Munich, but because, you know.
Yeah. It's pretty nuts. I texted you an image of this. We have this beautiful poster, Polish poster for it. Polish movie poster culture or whatever. Is it like, you know, they're never photo. It's never the studio art. It's never photo representations. It was basically a sort of a socialist thing of they'd get artists to create and design film posters, you know, to basically employ unemployed Polish artists, artists. And that I found that on a website that sells Polish movie posters years ago, but I searched for it. It was one of the first things I looked for, because I was like, wow, Deep End, I'll bet that's like really interestingly interpreted in, you know, like some, you know, guy out of art school, you know, in Krakow, like way. I only found it by discovering that it was listed on their website as a West German movie. So from there, I was like, why is this with a West German? Is it a co-production? Was it a West German distributor or whatever? And then poking around, again, this is a decade ago or whatever. This is a little harder to find out back then. Discovered that like, well, no, actually for economic reasons, it was shot almost entirely in Germany, you know?
Wow.
I don't think there's any confusion about where it's supposed to be taking place, but like for whatever reason, like as if England wasn't the cheapest place on earth at the time to shoot a movie, they actually had to go to Munich to make it even cheaper. So
yeah, and that bathhouse or pool house,
the Newford Baths, right?
Newford Baths, yeah.
That's my Rollins back tattoo. It's Newford Baths.
Yeah, that is an incredible location. I mean, yeah. You know, it's also just. There, you know, a lot of movies like this period, I just watched something else last, oh, we'll get to it, where, you know, there's all these things that seem they're on the verge of being knocked down, or like they're like right at the end of like their social lifespan in a way, you know.
Sure.
And this one is just like capturing practices. You're like, wait, so at this point, some people still took one big bath of the week or something like that at the bathhouse, or, you know, that this was... You know, that's kind of great. And actually made me think of a new movie I saw that now I kind of feel like sort of borrows a lot from Deep End. Empire of Light, which is this new movie by the director of 1917 and American Beauty, Sam Mendes.
Oh boy.
We don't have to spend any more, but I just want to point it out because it's set in a like old movie palace in the early 80s. That's on its way out and also is like this locus of like sexual frustration and has like a disused wing that people go to meet, like the main two people in the movie go to meet and whatever. Sort of like in this movie has this like Mike goes and meets with the Jane Asher character in like this kind of like courtyard or like, I don't know what it is. Just like,
oh yeah,
you know, it's just, I don't know. A lot of it sort of felt similar in terms of, you know, having this old place that is also feels like barely inhabited most of the time.
I think it's like a sort of a ritual British behavior, sort of social construct that certainly has fallen well by the wayside. But just that, you know, one of the sort of the many kind of fascinating threads for me as a tremendous admirer of post-war British movies and especially of post-war, you know, what I think of as sort of Edie Levy era, like 60s into the early 70s, 50s into the early 70s, you know, kind of B and exploitation movies. One of those things that you just don't see represented in American life and certainly not in my, you know, essentially kind of like, you know, upper middle class suburban American life at the time is just the idea that you would need, there would have to be, your own plumbing is so rotten, so lousy and inadequate that you would actually have to go to a public bath. And then the other part of that, which is like that the public baths wound up being this opportunity in a society that is, you know, essentially like conducts itself in this kind of, you know, kind of parochial way. It was a, you know, the public baths are also an opportunity to sort of try to arrange or, you know, habituate, you know, sexual conquests and liaisons of one kind or another that weren't permitted or weren't available or what have you. I mean, I think of the sort of British public baths film festival, would have to include Quadrophenia, because there's a great scene in that where I think it's Ray Winstone plays the rocker friend of the lead guy in Quadrophenia. And he just hears this guy in the next bathtub singing Bebopalula, the Gene Vincent song. And they don't connect sexually or whatever, but like, it's just a moment that would have to take place in a public bath in the UK in the mid 60s. And then the other one is, you remember in The Long Good Friday, the guy, the traitorous guy that sort of sets off the whole plot, he gets murdered in a public bath while he's ostensibly successfully come on to another dude. But it turns out the other dude is like an Irish assassin, an IRA assassin that kills him.
Oh, wow.
Sinister kind of centralness, sinister, non-sinister kind of potential centralness to the public baths in England of that era, in the same way that there would be for like, I don't know, like a shopping mall or whatever in like more in my formative era, you know, like whatever, the Tyson's Corner Mall, like just this, you know, it's there, you got to use it, you know. And as you say, like caught in that moment where like, you know, plumbing's improving, like you can bathe at home now, like, you know, unless there's something you're actually looking for or need in a public bath situation, like, you know, I assume they were all sort of like done and dusted by, you know, but certainly by the early 80s, you know, or close to. I toured in the UK for the first time. My first lengthy visit to England was a 2.5 week tour of one-nighters with a band. I mean, it was an amazing experience. This sort of moment where like everybody was looking for the next Nirvana, and this band I was in very inaccurately was sort of lumped in with some of these other bands. And so we went over and did a Peel session, which was the way that you paid for these things back then or whatever. And this is in 1992. And even then you could see these vestiges of, I mean, we didn't go to any public baths, and I saw one or two, but they did seem to be closed, or like, you know, England at that moment, it was a little hard to tell sometimes what was closed and what wasn't. England really did kind of like way more than I think than, you know, the United States or the parts of the United States that I lived or traveled in at the time. You know, these crumbling, as you say, these crumbling institutions are sort of physical remnants of like social directions or whatever that don't exist anymore, economic, you know, situations that, you know, that herald these things that don't exist anymore. Those buildings would kind of hang in because nobody was in a big hurry to develop over them, you know, less so than here. So I don't know, the England that I traveled in 1992, and it was a great way to see it because it was like 2.5 nights of one night club gigs. I mean, this wasn't any, you know, big expensive, you know, hotel kind of thing, you know, we're sleeping on people's floors and stuff like that. You got to see these places. You got to walk by these places, at least, you know, in the morning on the way back to the tour bus, and just realize like, wow, you know, they haven't changed much over here, but I think it's because they kind of can't afford to change much over here. Cut to London now, which is like, you know, it's as horrifying as New York. I mean, like everything's like just being raised or,
oh yeah,
you know, glass or, you know, whatever painted over.
Yeah, I don't know. I was reading some article where like all the townhouse fronts you see, they're like secretly like these enormous pools that they've drilled like 100 feet down into the yeah, Soho earth or something.
As opposed to this sort of the, you know, this kind of like essentially sort of social rust belt, residential rust belt kind of vibe that you got in so much of England, because England was so determinedly industrial and it failed so miserably, you know, that like, you know, after World War II, there's just like, you know, like everything got unplugged, but nothing got put away. You know?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And actually, you know, speaking of like the, you know, encounters that you might seek out in a bath like this, that might be one good bridge, along with just the time period, to another film that we were going to talk about. I see her character's listed in the always helpful IMDb as Mike's first lady client. I have no idea. I don't know. Was this cast list written by someone from 1970? Anyway, that actress is Diana Dors, and she is also in another movie that I'm going to have to leave you to talk about because I have not seen it, but I want to hear all about it. And that movie is Baby Love.
Well, nothing would make me happier than talking about Baby Love, but I got to like interrupt myself and point out that another, like maybe the central film in the Public Baths Film Festival, which we're going to book at Roxy and nobody will come to, would be the Joseph Losey's final movie, Steaming, where the entire movie takes place in a public bath and in fact is the last role for Diana Dors. So
that's great.
All roads lead back to her and to British public baths.
So anyone listening, that's our program. So you have to get in touch with us if you do that.
Yeah. No, you stole it from us.
Yeah.
Baby Love is one of the, like, again, I got on this Hammer kick maybe 6 years ago. I mean, my wife is into those movies. My wife is a, you know, she doesn't run at it at the same way that I do. And she's, you know, she's never like sort of cultivated this stuff as a living, but she's a huge, huge, huge movie buff. And like, I married into a huge pile of DVDs that I was very, very happy to, kind of take on as community property. And she has a lot of enthusiasm for, you know, sort of for exploitation-y end horror stuff, and especially more, you know, kind of vintage stuff. And so, you know, to some degree, you know, and like romancing her or whatever, just like cohabitating, I started watching a bunch of Hammer movies for the first time in a while. And it just dovetailed into, I just started watching all of this British exploitation stuff. And I'm still sort of pursuing it in this kind of avid, like, you know, like, wow, I didn't know about this kind of way. And one of the things that I did last year, I guess it was last year, was I started picking off all of these movies that were produced by a guy named Michael Klinger, who he was a partner with Tony Tenzer in a company called Tygon. And Klinger is like producer of record or co-producer of record on some really good movies like Repulsion and Cul-de-Sac. And then just like some really like pretty daunting and pretty ramshackle exploitation movies. One of which is this picture, Baby Love, which did really, really good business in England when it came out, and I think in 69. And it's not the first role for, but it's the first starring role for a really good actress named Linda Hayden, who She's in a movie that's like, that's it recently seems to have kind of gotten a better reputation, or people are taken more seriously, called The Blood on Satan's Claw. Do you know that picture? Gavin ran it in one of the first horror things that they did at Film Society. It might've been the first year that they did that.
Oh, wow.
It's like a lot of British horror movies. It's sort of Hammer adjacent, but it's also like a lot of British horror movies of the late 60s. There's this really tortured sexuality in it. And Linda Hayden is like, it never fails to amaze me when an actress has the ability to really, really fiercely carry a character despite being completely naked. For you know, it's sort of like, you ever see that Tobe Hooper movie Life Force?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe less dignity in that case, but a French actress named Mathilde Mai, who it literally walks through the entire movie totally naked. And it just, you know, after a while, you're just kind of like, it's, you know, it's presented up front, no pun intended, as you know, as essentially titillation or whatever, but it just winds up being this like sort of, I don't know, it's just like another, yet another character, you know, another factor in this actor's determined creation of this character. And in Linda Hayden's case, certainly in Blood and Satan's Claw, where she essentially is this witch, temptress, villain kind of character, Baby Love is more the Teorama kind of business model, whatever narrative model. Like, you know, irresistibly hot, youthful love object is ushered into, you know, sort of morally bankrupt, you know, bourgeois household, and havoc wreaking complications ensue. That's to some degree the pitch, but it winds up being, it's a really shockingly tender movie about incredibly damaged people. And it does have like this kind of like, you know, kind of thudding, vaguely anarchic, you know, again, swinging London thing. Like everybody just seems to be trying so hard to act out in this, you know, I'm liberated, hip free kind of way. And it's multi-generational because what, you know, what Linda Hayden's character does in Baby Love is she messes with the mind of the father, the son, who's her own age, and really principally by the end, the mother. And everybody is just like sort of, including her, are sort of helpless in the face of her charms, and also helpless in the face of their own like sort of weird projections of parochialism. But it, like Deep End, it's a magnificently shot movie. And it wasn't shot in Munich. It was shot in cruddy old London at its you know, cruddy old Londonist. It just knocked me out. I mean, I bought it outright from Network, which is a, you know, DVD distribution company in the UK. And I was so happy that I did, because it's like, and, you know, I think as you discovered, it's not easy to find. It's not easy to see unless you buy a Region 2 DVD from the UK. And it's really good. It's really unusual. And as I say, it steps away from this exploitation pitch of like, you know, what if the, you know, the 15-year-old nymphette, like, you know, walked into your home kind of thing, into this really tender and kind of traumatized kind of thing that, like, it really stuck with me. Whatever, I guess it's sort of a cliche thing to say, what critically or whatever, but it's a film that's ripe for rediscovery, because it's not at all what it presents as, you know. And I think it's not at all what the majority of the film viewers in England in whatever it was, 1969, were sort of expecting when they walked in the door. The guy that directed it, Alistair Reed, was a very seriously accomplished stage director. And there's a couple of things. There's the one full reel of this movie in the least ostentatious way possible. And I realized it on first viewing, but I really had to look at it on second viewing to appreciate this. There's one whole reel that's an uninterrupted single take, and you'd kind of never realize it because it's so not about like, look at me, I'm moving the camera. It winds up being this almost like Elizabethan theater thing, like people kind of like going upstage and downstage and entering right and entering left. And it just doesn't seem... It plays very organically, and it's an extremely sinister scene, and it's an extremely sinister daylight exterior scene, which is to me is a little bit unusual to begin with, this sort of sexual peril and stuff. And it's just magnificently directed. And in order to be magnificently directed in a way like a moving master shot like that is, it's also magnificently acted. You know, everybody's turning on an emotional and conflictory dime, you know, to kind of, to enter in, to pick each other up, to come back to, you know, to down, as I say, downstage, upstage, everything else. And it's like, I just was knocked out. I was just watching this thing going like, wow. I mean, like, did you guys rehearse this for a month? I mean, like, I guess it's what you get when you have really good actors, you know, and you have their full attention. You can make this kind of stuff happen. But I just can't imagine, like, in a contemporary movie, a single uninterrupted take of real length of, like, you know, basically it's like 9 or 10 minutes long, being accomplished without there being, you know, whatever, some CGI element or just some feeling that like, oh golly, like, look at this, you know,
right,
where a director is, you know, is letting us in on his or her, you know, like magnificently, you know, ambitious attempt at, you know, and it's, you know, it's not Steadicam. It's not overtly handheld. It's certainly not Steadicam, hadn't been invented, but it's also not this kind of Orson Welles, like crany, zoopy or Scorsesean, you know, like in, out, up, down kind of thing. It's just played, I guess, sort of apropos of Deep End. It's just played from the right narrative eye all the way through. And it's really, it's kind of a knockout scene in a really, in I think a valedictorily depressing movie about, you know, the sort of, you know, the unbreachable chasms between people who have emotional needs, you know?
Yeah.
Deanna Dorn's features in it in flashbacks, or Diane, I've never quite figured out like what, like where are you supposed to go with that? She figures in it in flashbacks, and she's, you know, I don't know, like her crazy shelf life, like, you know, I wonder to what degree she seemed like sort of, I mean, she's almost like divine or something, like this like sort of parody of feminine pulchritude, you know, certainly in Deep End, and Baby Love was made around the same time, you know, like at what point she sort of surrendered to that, you know, because she was to some degree the British Marilyn Monroe, you know, in the mid 50s on, but like, you know, she just seems like this kind of like Macy's Thanksgiving balloon, you know, in a lot of her latter day career kind of stuff. And Baby Love is no exception. I mean, she's sort of kind of hysterical and suicidal and heartbroken, and in these very jagged flashbacks that I think, again, like unostentatiously, but I think very clearly are meant to be from a 15-year-old girl's memory and 15-year-old girl's sort of narrative point of view. But she rocks it, you know, she was the right weird sort of semi-caricature screen presence for the job.
Yeah, wow.
You should see it. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, I want to, yeah. There's something also just, I don't know if it's related also just to this time period where like people are kind of testing out, it's clear, it has to be clear, but just about everyone that like certain boundaries are shifting or gone, and how people, I mean, Deep End is a great title for the moment in a way. It's like suddenly people are in the deep end or wading out to there and don't know how far to go. And you can get these movies that get under your skin in this way. And not at all on the level of Baby Love, I'm sure. But, you know, I happened to watch as part of background viewing for a review I had to do for a movie that starred Jenny Agutter. Or
I've never figured it out. Okay. Is it Agutter?
I have no idea.
The one that drives me crazy currently is a little more obscure, is that there's a magnificent British DP who unfortunately died young. He wound up working with Sam Peckinpah to great effect, Don Siegel, some other people. And depending on who you listen to, it's either John Coquillan or it's John Coquillon. And I think we'll just never get to the bottom of that one. So I think it's the same problem with, is she a gutter or is she an Agutte?
Agutte. I'm going to go with a gutter just on the Britishness of it. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I watched a movie called I Start Counting.
Oh yeah,
which is actually from like a song in the movie that's sung in like this ethereal, like, I don't know, like Margot Gurian kind of, you know, way. It's very odd. By a person who I don't think ever recorded anything ever again, also weirdly. And anyway, Jenny Agutter plays like this girl who is having crushes and has a friend, and they're each claiming that they're like, you know, going far with boys, and they're just in this, you know, frenzy of hormones. But yeah, there's this underlying like unease through all of it. And also a movie where there's technique kind of embedded in what's like just sort of like a standard issue like thriller format, where she's trying to figure out who in her immediate circle of family or family friends might be, you know, a tabloid murderer.
Yeah, I have seen this picture.
Yeah. Yeah. But the director, whose name escapes me, actually just takes real care with his like compositions that he starts things with. There's so many like memorable things. And I found myself just doing screen grabs sort of left and right of just to kind of isolate these little pictures he was doing and these little, you know, like and it's great. You know, this whole like shot that he orchestrates just so he can have, I think it's Jenny Agutter's character's brother holding up a True Detective magazine. All these things that he's doing, that's, you know, didn't need to be that way. Also a movie very much in a decaying setting. In this case, it's like a house that they all had to move out of and that is about to be destroyed. And one thing that's left behind in this house is a rack like for holding milk bottles that you would obviously put out, and it had a little dial on it, which you could set the number, like a little clock of how many milk bottles you were putting out or getting back or something. So you could set 1, 2, 3, 4.
Wow.
So yeah, which is, I love that sort of stuff.
I need one of those.
Yeah.
The director, Wikipedia reminds me, is a guy named David Green.
Okay.
And he made a picture that absolutely traumatized me as a kid called The Shuttered Room. It appears to have had the sort of unfortunate career trajectory that a lot of like outrageously talented British UK directors of the 60s and 70s wound up having. Like they either wound up getting buried in British TV, or they'd come to the United States and just, you know, get like direct episodes of Baywatch and stuff, you know, like Sidney Hayers, who's a director whose work I absolutely love. He just wound up like doing like just dreck on TV in the US. And that seems to have been David Green's fate, you know, because basically the bottom went out. Like the US studio money vanished from England in the 70s. And then by the 80s, like the Edie levy, you know, all these basically these sort of quotas and sweetheart deals that British production kind of relied on to churn out all of this stuff. Like Thatcher put an end to all of that. So these guys just all like went from making 2, 3, 4 pictures a year to like, you know, doing shitty episodic television in the US or, you know, marginally better episodic television in the UK. You know, the guy Alistair Reed that did Baby Love, you know, I guess he won a BAFTA or whatever for the original TV, UK TV version of Traffic, you know. That landscape, rather than continuing to make like these, you know, weirdly sort of challenging B movies, you know, like high-minded exploitation fare, you know, because that moment just passed, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. It's like this, I'll just exaggerate and say lost generation or something.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing for me is that like, I'm trying to think the right way to describe this. You kind of stumble through the swamp of film history. You kind of connect the dots with the stuff that like, you know, makes you enthusiastic enough to want to connect the dots in the first place. It's just a constant reminder. And maybe this is just once again, middle age speaking, but the constant reminder is like, well, we're never going to have that business model again. this isn't an angel investor that, you know, digs my Twitter feed. You know, this isn't like, you know, like a, you know, first look deal with a streaming company or whatever. Like, it's just never going to happen again. Like this, you know, the sort of the demos, the expectations, you know, on the audience side. And then I think more than anything else, the way that like filmmakers, quote unquote, wind up being educated, learning their craft. Like, it's just that doesn't, the way that these guys and these movies wind up getting made, it's just never going to line up like that again, which is too bad because it means we're never going to have movies like that again, but whatever.
But we can still talk about the old ones, I guess. As everything, as we go through our new phase of everything crumbling.
Yeah.
But I think we talk about two films that are right around 69 and 70, and that'll easily vault us over to another movie from the period, from a well-known director and well-established. But I think even for people who know this director's work, this movie is probably going to be a bit of a surprise and definitely gave me shocks. This is a movie where he basically seems like he thought, well, why does everything have to happen at the end? What if it all just happened in the first 5 minutes? You know?
Oh, it's insane. is it Le Rupture or La Rupture?
Yeah, La Rupture.
Yeah, it seems like it would go to my I took French 1 3 times. So like, you know, like that my sense from that is it sounds like a le, not a la.
Yeah.
The breach is what it's listed as mostly. I had lunch with a friend yesterday and I wound up talking about it and he looked it up on Mubi and they have it listed as The Breach. So apparently that's what that translates to. That movie is fucking insane. It's like, what century does it take place in? Like, where are we? It's just, yeah, you know, you go. You're fresher from it.
Right. I have more immediate need for therapy right now. Yeah. I mean, so this is a Claude Chabrol joint from 1970. And I mean, you know, if there's one thing, I mean, I did recently watch Le Ceremony again. So it's not as if you don't expect sometime there might be a explosive moment in a Chabrol, but often it's this kind of simmering on the kind of, you know, warped surfaces of the bourgeois life in some way, or like some sort of historical awful thing. In this case, you know, he just starts right off the bat with a French housewife at home, just seems a bit harried. She's feeding her kid, who is like, his nose barely peeks over the breakfast table. He seems like the tiniest thing on screen you can imagine. And then her husband, AKA basically like Frankenstein. I mean, he looks like a character from like a Paul Morrissey horror movie at the time or something. Like he lurches out of the back bedroom and is in the throes of something. Like he carries the aura of like, he's from another movie into this moment. And I don't think you'd be any less shocked if I tell you that he is violent both towards his wife and toward the child in like just incredible way. And so she immediately flees and has to treat her child bring her child to the hospital. And she kind of takes up residence at a boarding house right next door to the hospital in her kind of days just to be near the kid. And she just is taken there by a doctor. And so we have another like place, like we've been talking about a bit, where
it's another crumbling mansion. Totally. Yeah.
Exactly. That just feels lost in time. You know, I mean, there's almost something like, you know, Buñuelian about it. You know, she goes in there. There are three women who have for eternity been playing cards at this one table in like the ground floor. And there's a thespian. I can't call him an actor. There's a thespian who's staying there, whose name is in a completely inscrutable pun, Gerard Mostel. You know, I have to think that's a pun on Zero Mostel. Like, I don't know. Like, and he's this, you know, he's a parody of like the Balzac statue, Rodin, you know, this giant cloak, you know, this the artiste, and he's always making pronouncements. But anyway, so she's just trying to keep a handle on things. But, you know, of course, her husband has this wealthy like family, and you can immediately chart for yourself. They don't have to explain anything. Clearly, this kid had, you know, whatever he wanted, and at that time, you know, fell into drugs or whatever. But there's the thing about this movie, I don't know, every single thing that could be weird in some way has something with it. So like his rich dad, for example, the way they ask the actor to perform it is as if he's a ventriloquist. His lips never seem to move. Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. There's a lot of like sort of different theatrical currents running through that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something like that for everything is just a little extra, you know, like, I mean, you know, and in the boarding house, like the couple that runs the boarding house, the husband is a lush, but he might as well have like soap bubbles coming out of his head, you know? And
her or X's over his eyes and like a bright red nose. Yeah. And like hanging on a lamppost.
And their daughter, you know, has, you know, some psychological troubles but is wearing these like crazy, like Coke bottle glasses and like
big funny teeth too. Yeah. She might have like Jerry Lewis, you know, funny teeth.
Yeah. It's.
And did you notice that's her in the Stag film?
Oh no.
I'm almost positive it's the same actor. It is bewildering to me. This movie just seems to have like sort of marginalized itself. There's so little written about it. It was difficult for me to even identify what that actress's name was who plays the sort of the touched daughter. But I'm almost positive that's her. Sort of there winds up being, for the folks at home, there winds up being this, it's so convoluted but like sort of cooks along like a dream. Like you never really sort of stop to go like, okay, wait, who's, you don't ask what I always think of as like watching TV with my mother questions. Is that his friend or whatever? Like it never comes up. You sort of, the illogic of it all just somehow adds up. And so at one point, the illogic of it all delivers this like sinister Stag film that a couple of characters are watching or showing. And it's, I guess it's her watching herself, although it's not really presented that way. It's just, I don't know.
That's crazy.
Weird, scummy layers to that movie. It's,
yeah,
it's really.
Yeah. And Jean-Pierre Cassel, who is that Vincent Cassel's dad? I think. I'm not sure. It seems like it could be because he has this kind of like.
Has the charm.
Yeah. He has the charm. And it is he plays this complete sleaze who's assigned to like swindle the mother who just looks like this immaculate walking like magazine photo spread. Stéphane Audran.
Who was Mrs. Chabrol at the time?
Well, that sometimes comes through when that happens in movies. And she ends up being this kind of pretty much like this moral paragon, and everyone's expecting something to break, but she's not going to be it. And I mean, this is, you know, speak of Ripe for Discovery, this is like another movie, like you kind of hear her roar in a way, you know.
Sure.
This is a good movie because it's narrative wise, because it never quite breaks the way you're going, even as it's pushing as far as you think it can go. And the guy whose name is Paul Thomas, or Paul Thomas, this kind of go-between who's assigned to ruin her life, and who sets up this, well, I don't give away too much away, but he has this in live-in girlfriend who is another like over-the-top character. You know, I'll just say it because the movie's portraying like this oversexed gamine character,
right,
who never appears to leave her room, that he says, he's like, he goes there and he says, oh, it stinks in here. You know, she just sits there and like, it's just like this, not a real person, you know, but this movie is like full of these weird caricatures. And yet it never swings. It never like careens out of control. It was like an eye-opening experiment that kind of succeeds, you know? I mean,
I would say that I'd never seen anything like it before, except that prior to watching it, I'd also seen The Champagne Murders, which is a Chabrol movie from a year or two earlier.
Mm.
And Chabrol, like, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Chabrol made, I don't know, 20 movies. Like, I don't really see getting around to, you know, all of them, you know, in what time I have left. But
sure,
based on the fact that there's 20 movies to pick from, I'd seen maybe three or four of them. And they're sort of like randomly located throughout his career. He just went through this moment of these like insane sort of highly theatrical thriller farces. Maybe farce is too strong a word. And The Champagne Murders is definitely one of them. Like it's like there, it's definitely of a set with Le Rupture. And she, Stéphane Audran is in that. And she plays multiple characters and she's in like bright red lingerie for most of it. And it's just, I mean, it's just, both of those movies are so nuts in such similar ways and in such a determined kind of way. I mean, the thing I thought about a bit, I mean, you know, and again, like there's not much written about, certainly about The Rupture, and there should be. What you do read about Chabrol is that sort of the low-hanging fruit critically, or, you know, kind of like career assessment-wise, is like, oh, he was a devotee, sorry about the noise, a devotee of Hitchcock's, or like, and it's much more of a Fritz Lang thing to me, you know, because Fritz Lang, I think, it was so much more sort of spanning a 19th century or early 20th century idea of pulp storytelling, you know, and theatricality, like sort of genre theatricality. And like whatever, like he was kind of coming up with in the, you know, at the moment that he was making his films, there always seemed to be sort of a rearward looking thing in Fritz Lang's movies or his best movies about like the kind of stuff that probably scared and excited him when he was a kid, because it really does seem like it's just such a weird throwbacky movie, you know, it's like a throwback and a throw forward and a throw sideways all at the same time.
Yeah.
I said, it looks amazing. Just an incredibly cool looking movie.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Roll, I think, worked with the same, it's the same guy that worked on a whole bunch of his movies. And there's just these really great, like sort of lucid and abrupt camera moves. And just a really, like a really nicely, and maybe it was the labs in France or whatever the film stock they used, what have you, like this really nice reduced kind of color palette. You know, it's just not a, there's a lot of garish kind of situations, but there's not really a whole lot of garish kind of photography in it.
Yeah.
Crazy movie.
Yeah.
But very successfully so.
Yeah. Very successfully crazy.
Like what a weird idea of, I guess there's, what drugs is he on? Do we know? Like, and the, like she gets dosed with, I guess it's giving stuff away or whatever, but like, you know, there's LSD in the mix. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, it's so not of its time and of its time at the same time. You know, there's no, I don't think there's a note of rock and roll anywhere in it, but people have long hair and are like, you know, dosing each other in LSD.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Jean-Pierre Casal character just like literally running around, sprinting to and from the sort of the attempts and results of his various, you know, like schemes to, do I have this right? He's been hired to discredit her so she won't get an amicable divorce settlement when she breaks up inevitably with this guy, this rich son, this fortunate son that like smacked their kid into a wall and beat her up, you know, at the behest of fortunate son's parents. And it's just, it's bonkers and it doesn't let up.
Yeah, that is correct. that is what goes down. And I just because I just looked it up, the cinematographer, Jean Rabier, and I totally agree.
He shot Le Boucher. I mean, he shot like whatever, like the five other Chabrol movies that came out that year. just super lucid, you know, and that's the Chabrol thing is like, what, I guess it's unfair to like, you know, get out the big paintbrush and start splashing around about these guys or whatever. But like, you know, of that generation of filmmakers, what I guess people, you know, inevitably refer to as the French New Wave, you know, he was a guy that was really connected to kind of this, that it was like, you can't, it's nothing wrong with liking William Wyler movies. And there's also nothing wrong with actually like trying to cop the moves in them and stuff, you know, which is like, I don't think is a hang up that like, or an interest that he shared with that many of his sort of Kaye generation peers, you know? So it's like, it's pretty intense because it's this pretty wild burlesque of fairly traditional Hollywood narrative film grammar, you know, through a lot of it. And like, that's, it's not what Godard was up to, you know, it's not even what Truffaut was up to at the time, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I really like that. I really like that about it. And I really like that about his other movies. And, you know, maybe I got to change course and start picking off the other 17, you know?
Yeah. It's like so much of other Chabrol films are about all the crap that goes down here, just peeking through the cracks later, you know, like,
right.
You know, here it's just all of it, you know, it's all happening and it's all right up front. And, you know, it's like a movie that, you know, it almost feels like seeds of some of the stuff that's in some of the stuff that's in Giallos a little bit, you know, just in this, yeah, this weird kind of daymare, you know, daytime nightmare kind of thing. You know, also feels like Frenzy, like it's the same kind of like skeeziness going on. Pretty amazing. And the way in which it might be of the time is that, especially with this husband character who, yeah, just seems like this zombie nightmare of what would happen to your son, you know, like I feel like bottling the lightning of like some social upheaval, but it doesn't come across as like an old man trying to get in touch with what's going on. He just like lets freak flag fly, basically, you know. It's like,
you know, I think the Frenzy comparison is super apt because it's, and you know, quality of Frenzy that's maybe a little difficult to appreciate from this distance is it's pretty fiercely throwbacky itself. I mean, at the same time, it's like super of the moment in terms of like not gnarly sex and violence, you know, just the comedy and the sort of the vision of England in whatever year that was, 1970, is so like sweetly out of touch, I think, with how things actually sort of had gotten, you know, in England at that time. You know, I think it's very much Hitchcock, like having this kind of like, you know, more operating from his memory of England of the, you know, the 30s or whatever, you know, and then, you know, bending a sort of new permissiveness, you know, what was possible in the new permissiveness in terms of like setting up sex murders, basically, like sort of dovetailing that in there. Cause like the comedy in Frenzy is really like goofy and dorky and, you know, the cast and the fashions and all that kind of stuff. It does, it's similarly throwbacky and similarly sort of threadbare in the color department too, which is pretty hip.
Yeah, that's true. And that is that this peculiar quality of some of these movies of, yeah, like you were saying, looking back, looking to the side, looking to the future all at the same time a little bit.
That's part one of my conversation with Bruce Bennett. Stay tuned for more movies in part two. You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.